Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. The prevalence of chronic pelvic pain in women appears to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 10%, depending on the study that you're looking at. But it also turns out only about one-third of these women who might have chronic pelvic pain actually seek medical care. Chronic pelvic pain is a very common reason for referral to a gynecologist and turns out to be the principal reason for about 1 in 5 hysterectomies and almost half of all gynecological laparoscopies in the United States each year. On this edition of Line One, Your Health Connection, our guest is Anchorage pelvic pain specialist Dr. Bradford Fenton, and we're going to try to learn a little bit more about the causes and remedies for chronic pelvic pain, and we're going to leave that in women. There are men that have chronic pelvic pain, but we're going to be talking about women and chronic pelvic pain today. Dr. Fenton received his MD and PhD from Boston University. His PhD is in neuroscience. He completed his OBGYN residency at Georgetown University. And he's been practicing since graduating and doing a lot of chronic pelvic pain. And he's actually done some research as well as publishing in the fields of chronic pain, gynecologic laparoscopic surgery, and the neurosciences issues related to chronic pain. And finally, he serves on the board of directors for the International Pelvic Pain Society. Dr. Fenton, welcome to Line One.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you have questions as a listener today, there are a couple of ways you can get in touch with us. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Dr. Fenton, the way I almost start every program is by getting some definitions. And so one of the hardest parts for a radio program and the hardest things to ask a guest is to describe some things and define some things that often need pictures. But tell us what the pelvis is, what structures we're talking about.
All right. So starting from the anterior wall, there is the anterior abdominal wall, which is an often overlooked part of the pelvis. It forms the front of the pelvis, and it has a number of muscular and nervous structures in it. And then the very bottom of the pelvis is the pelvic floor. It has a number of different openings for the urethra, the vagina, the rectum. And it's made up of a series of different muscles. And again, going through that is another series of nerves. The posterior part of the pelvis is mostly bony. It's made up of the sacrum and is less involved usually in pain syndromes, except those that are going to involve the muscles of the back. And then the rest of the pelvis is sort of a bowl of these muscles that sits at the very bottom end of your abdominal pelvic cavity. Mm-hmm. Sitting in this space, there's a number of different organs that we're commonly looking at, sort of going from the front back. You have the bladder and urethra. This is involved in bladder pain syndromes. Just behind that, you have the vagina. At the top of the vagina is the uterus connected to the tubes and ovaries. All of these have their own separate sort of pain syndromes that go with them. Further behind that is the rectum and the rest of the bowel. Bowel's involved in its own set of pain syndromes. And then at the very outside part of the pelvis and the dependent portion is the vulva or vulvar vestibule, and that has its own set of interesting sort of skin-based pain problems.
Yeah, when you say the vulva, you're talking about the outside genitalia on a woman in particular.
Correct. Okay. It's divided into labia majora, labia minora. Mm-hmm. Inside the labia minora is the vestibule, and that's where some women have a particular skin pain problem known commonly as vulvodynia, but actually has been reclassified to be more precise, and it's really vestibulodynia.
So one of the reasons for pointing out all the structures in my mind is the understanding or preconceived notion that pain can have its origins in any of those areas and manifest as chronic pelvic pain. In fact, it may be also fair to say pain may originate outside of the pelvis but still appear to be coming from the pelvis?
You are correct, indeed. there's all sorts of nerves that go down into the pelvis, and at the ends of these nerves are all sorts of receptors. These receptors can be upregulated or downregulated. Sometimes you have a whole second set of pain receptors. They're called silent nociceptors, which normally are, well, silent. And then they turn on under a pain stimulus of some sort and then never turn off again. Mm-hmm. And so you have what apparently looks totally normal to you, but the patient is complaining bitterly of pain because she has activation of either the peripheral nociceptors or the silent nociceptors or second messengers in those nerve endings. But as you mentioned, these nerves are then connected through synapses to the spinal cord. And in the spinal cord, there are several different levels of processing. And this is another spot where these nerves can sort of go on all by themselves without any control. And then you continue to have burning and pain, but it doesn't have a peripheral origin. It has more of a central origin. And even further up from there, pain tracks ascend through two different tracks, and then they sort of rattle around in the deep brain, and then through the midbrain, then thalamus, and then out to the cortex, almost simultaneously to three different cortical networks that are involved in pain perception that each have their own little tidbit of the pain experience to go on to it. And these can all take on their own sort of dysregulation syndromes where you have pain sort of running amok, where otherwise you look at someone and say, well, I don't see much.
Mm-hmm. I was going to get into a description of pain, and I think it might be worthwhile, but my mind immediately jumped to the fact that you have a PhD in neuroscience, and then you told me before the program how you got into pelvic pain. It seems like maybe you would have gotten into pain in some way or the other eventually anyway.
It's certainly likely. It's an interesting job that just sort of landed in my lap, uh-huh. and I happen to have a PhD in neuroscience, so when I was offered the opportunity to run a subspecialty clinic in either chronic pelvic pain or menopause, I was like, oh, chronic pelvic pain. That's, you know, vaguely in my area. I've done research in neuroscience. I can run with that. And it's been really nothing but invaluable uh-huh. for helping to understand and empathize with these patients who come in with really an average score of 8 out of 10. And they're sitting there calmly saying, oh, yeah, my pain's an 8 out of 10. And being able to intellectually realize that this can be coming from a lot of different spots makes it, I don't know, maybe easier or better for me to be able to lay out the different treatment options for them and not just say, oh, well, you get a laparoscopy and then you're done and I know what to do after that. It's like, well, mm-hmm. there's a lot to do mm-hmm. depending on what you got and where you want to go.
Mm-hmm. Let me take just a second. I want to remind listeners once again, this is Line One, your health connection. My guest today is Dr. Bradford Fenton. Dr. Fenton, is an obstetrician gynecologist, primarily practicing, I think, you're doing some OB work too.
Just a little.
But you have a particular interest in chronic pelvic pain and particularly neuroscience. So we are here, and he is more than happy to address your questions and comments and even your experiences if you want to share them about chronic pelvic pain. So the way to get a hold of us in the next 45 minutes or so is our local number, 550-8433, email us during the next 45 minutes, line1, and you spell that out, LINEONE, line1@alaskapublic.org, or if you need a toll-free phone number, 1-888-353-5752. All right, so you threw a lot of fancy words about neurology and synapses and thalamuses and stuff. Let's go back to the basics of pain, and you can start wherever you want. You want to start on the periphery, or you can start up in your noggin. But one way or the other, let's follow a pain, something that causes some pain or discomfort, and tell me what happens to that in our body once we have that happen to us.
All right, so let's talk about something a little more common and a little easier to get a hold of, which is the uterus. The uterus holds babies, and that's it. It's its sole purpose. Hold babies, grow babies, and it has a number of different anatomic issues that can happen to it. Commonly, the issues that I'm seeing are adenomyosis or fibroids, which are various types of little benign growths in the uterus that form little knots that can become inflamed and painful, and they lead to a lot of pain with periods and then a lot of pain with intercourse. So from the uterus has a number of different nerves that go to it. The peripheral nerves circle back up S2 and 3, which are the main sacral nerves, into the spinal cord. Here they're synapsing on the dorsal horn. They're ascending in two different columns as they go up to the different parts of your midbrain. Your midbrain is tucked deep in your skull and heavily protected by the boniest part of your skull because that's where a lot of your basic core bodily functions are regulated. The more interesting way stations in there are the hypothalamus, because that's where we think you can get a lot of the other dysregulations that go with pain are sort of put on top of the pain experience. So we were talking a little bit earlier off the air about dysautonomias. And it's not uncommon for patients who have severe pain syndromes or long-standing pain syndromes to develop other symptoms that come with their pain. So flushing or redness, sweating, those sort of things, particularly with organs like the uterus, which are inside the abdominal cavity, you can get a lot of nausea that goes with that, and that's because the pain is all tied together with other aspects of your autonomic nervous system, and that's deep in the midbrain. From there, it ascends to the thalamus. The thalamus is sort of a microbrain in and of itself. It has different sections that are devoted to different parts of your bodily functions, and pretty much every experience that you've got in terms of sensation has a way station in the thalamus. The thalamus is also interesting because as the way station for all of these experiences for severe pain patients, usually chronic back pain patients, you can actually take out a little bit of the thalamus, and that can provide pretty decent pain relief for a lot of those kind of patients. That's kind of aggressive and a little bit outside my realm for sure, way down in the pelvis, but it is proven to work. From the thalamus, the pain fibers spread out in three overlapping networks in your cortex. And the cortex is interesting for me because I can get to the cortex to do a lot of different research. I've looked, as part of the NASA Summa Neuroscience Center, we looked at the response of cortical neurons on EEG to different normal and pain states. And that was part of where we discovered that one of the pain networks is tied into the anterior cingulate cortex, is where you have your affective emotional opinion of your pain. Does pain make you, or experiences, actually experience of any kind? Does it make you happy? Does it make you sad? That's where you put your immediate sort of fight or flight, this is a great thing, or oh, this is bad, label on your experience. Visual, auditory, sensory, no matter what it is, that's where you're putting that on. And it turns out that patients who have chronic pain syndromes, chronic pelvic pain syndromes, have dysregulation in this area. They have an excess of delta wave activity. The reason we were interested in that is because we have a treatment for electrical dysregulation of the cortex, and that's non-invasive neurostimulation. I did some work with the people at Harvard who run those kind of protocols, looking at peripheral nerve syndromes and using central neurostimulation to try to control that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow, that is incredible. In the depth that we're talking here about neurology is pretty deep for primary care physician like myself, and I suspect for most obstetric gynecologists and so forth. So we have the fortunate to have a neuroscientist to describe that. But what it does for me is it really brings the analogy to a computer and where we're really talking about circuits and how different parts of the computer are interacting with other circuits very, very much to the forefront. It helps me understand how anatomically we can explain how, what we would call the biopsychosocial aspects of pain. What do I mean by that?
Well, several thoughts on what you were just mentioning. And one of the parts that I didn't get to and describe, which is the descending pain control system. So we talked about pain sensation and ascending pain control, but you have a complete set of descending pain control systems too that can totally wipe out pain. Mm-hmm. So you think of the mother who can lift a car off of her trapped child, or the Buddhist monk that can let themselves on fire and walk down the street until they finally collapse. The endurance athlete that can suppress the pain and burning in their legs just to keep on going. So you have a full set that's usually not under your immediate control, but you can certainly train to do that. You know, when the bear takes a bite out of your butt, you could just suppress that and keep on running because you're built to do that. You can suppress all your pain using a descending system. It starts in the frontal lobes, and you can train yourself to use those to your advantage. But that's not really what your immediate question was. Sorry.
That's all right.
Getting back to the biopsychosocial.
It was important to talk about the descending aspects of it, and I apologize for maybe not letting you get there.
No, I can ramble on for a good long time. So the biopsychosocial aspect of pain is what makes pain research really so fascinating, is because pain is very difficult to measure. The standard 1 to 10 scale is a very gross description of what the experience is, because and you can bring it straight back to the neuroscience. The neuroscience, the three overlapping pain networks, really gives you a good example of how the pain starts. Really, the one network starts at your posterior insular cortex, which says you've got pain, and that's tightly connected to your somatosensory map, which says where you've got pain, because knowing you've got pain is not nearly as useful as knowing where it is, because then you can withdraw that limb from the fire or whatever it is you're going to do about it. So you have to immediately know where is the pain and that you got pain. And the other one is the salience network of, well, how important is this? And that's the part where you sort of suppress when you've been bitten by the bear. But the example that I like to use is you've got a hammer, and every once in a while you hit your thumb with the hammer. And that's a very different experience than some guy in a hockey mask has just stabbed you in the thumb with a knife. Both of them have pain in your thumb, but they're both really different experiences. And so your psychosocial reaction to them will be totally different, and that's appropriate. If you hit your thumb with a hammer, you'll swear and jump around and not be very happy with yourself, but you don't do much else. A guy in a hockey mask hits you in the thumb with a hammer. Well, you better be moving, huh? And those are appropriate responses where you put on your emotional, you know, well, this is bad when you hit your hammer, but someone else attacking you, oh, that's real bad, you know, and your emotional valence of it goes from sort of anger when you hit your hand to fear when someone else does. And you put the appropriate psychosocial response on top of that based on what's happening around you. And so that's part of it. When we talk about measuring pain, I tend to use a system that was developed by your tax dollars and mine at the NIH called the PROMIS, a patient-reported outcomes measurement information system. And it breaks down your experience of life into a number of larger domains that are each individually measurable. And that starts with your physical domains, which talk about, well, what can you really do in your day? What's your physical capabilities? And then talks about pain. How bad is your pain? What do you have to do to make up for your pain? That's pain behavior. And then how does pain interfere in your life? That's pain interference. And it goes well beyond that to dig into other aspects of your life, all of which, by the way, are involved in chronic pain syndromes, such as your mental health, anger, anxiety, depression, your fatigue and sleep, sleep-related impairment, and also your social function. So as a gynecologist, when I'm talking about pelvic pain, this is very different than talking about thumb pain. If you can't have sex with your boyfriend or husband because you have pain every time that happens, well, that's going to be a big problem for you as a woman, for many women. And you're going to need to modify this somehow and fix this in order to, you know, maintain your social relationships appropriately. And that's where a lot of the decision-making process on the patient side comes in. Now, as the clinician, it's really my job to accurately diagnose all of different pain generators and then lay out for the patient the different treatment options available. And then it's the patient who knows herself way better than I do. You know, where is her social position? How does she feel about it? How aggressively does she want to manage her pain? Is it something that's really not a big deal for her, and so she wants a less aggressive approach? Or is this causing a serious catastrophe in her life, and she needs it fixed now, like tomorrow? And if it doesn't get done sooner, well, that's not good, and she's willing to take whatever risks are necessary to get this pain solved.
Mm-hmm. One more discussion before we get into the individual issues, is could you differentiate to listeners how pain specialists think about acute pain and chronic pain?
Certainly. So for the group that I'm a part of, the International Pelvic Pain Society, really we're often dealing with things that are best termed persistent pain syndromes. And although it's been called chronic pain for a while, it turns out that frequently there is an acute pain episode that's the beginning of the problem that many patients can identify. And acute pain is often managed very differently. It's managed with acute pain medications, and that's a wide range of those. And narcotics are sometimes appropriate depending on what you've got, because that's a particular class of medication that's good for pain, but you can't use it for too long because they have a lot of side effects. If you have an acute pain, say, let's talk about a yeast infection, causes burning and itching in the vulva and vagina, and then you treat that with a yeast infection cream or pill or whatever it is to get rid of the yeast infection itself, but the feeling never really goes away in some patients, and they go on, they develop a chronic pain syndrome, in this case, vulvar vestibulodynia would be, breaks down into primary and secondary provoked and unprovoked according to the new guidelines. And these patients are very unhappy because it feels like they have a yeast infection all the time when in fact the gynecologists are going in there, treating them with every yeast infection medicine under the sun and culturing them all the time, and they don't have anything. And that's because the nerves, like we talked about, the secondary nociceptors are all turned on in that particular little patch of skin, and they're running around all by themselves saying, you got pain, you got pain, you got pain, even though there's no more stimulus there. So it's turned from an acute pain of the infection into this persistent pain syndrome for reasons that we are really totally hypothesizing, our unregulated silent nociceptors.
So I've heard it said, when in, at least on this program or in my preparation for it, that acute pain has its origins and it's understood. But once you get into chronic pain, the one of the characteristics is whatever caused that acute pain in the first place is now gone. Doesn't mean the pain is gone, but the original reason for that pain is now gone. And so the issues are now different. And that's where patients can get into trouble by continuing to take narcotics for pain when that problem that caused the original pain is well gone and disappeared and is not present anymore. And so now the approach to that chronic pain should be different.
You are correct. Indeed, doesn't apply to all pain syndromes, mm-hmm. but a good number of the ones that we have in the pelvis is that there is some stimulus, some infection. Mm-hmm. You think, oh, well, you treat this infection, it goes away. So another example would be interstitial cystitis or painful bladder syndrome. Often there is a preceding urinary tract infection, which the woman comes in complaining, oh, I have burning when I pass my urine. I have to pee all the time because it just itches, it burns, and I need to do something about this. And you culture it, and it turns out to have something in it, and you treat it with an antibiotic, and the infection goes away. But the feeling that you've got this pain mm-hmm. never really resolves. And so that's when it changes from the acute pain to one of the chronic pain syndromes. And that's indeed where many physicians also have difficulty, because you have to really change your thinking about what the patient has. And that's intellectually very different to sort of pivot in place and say, oh, well, right. I wonder if you have something totally different than what I was expecting.
Mm-hmm. So it would seem to me that someone who's dealing Well, first off, you're doing a detailed history and physical, and you're trying to figure out whether this is acute pain or chronic pain. But if you now come to the conclusion that you think this is more of a chronic pain, then the historical aspects of what happened become really important, as well as this biopsychosocial aspects of things. That's where we start looking into what is continuing to cause and drive this chronic pain, this secondary pain, maybe not the right term, but the acute issue's gone, but now we got this thing, and so now that really broadens the whole scope of how we look at this problem, it seems to me.
Correct, and it spreads out from just the pain to a number of other issues. So, for example, we mentioned dysautonomias. You know, now she's having hot flashes, and she's sweating, and she gets nauseous when she has her period. And so In addition to the pain, she has to go run to the bathroom, throw up all the time. Mm-hmm. Or she's got to take something for nausea, and that's got its own set of side effects. Or often, for me, this is disrupting their sleep. They have some sort of chronic pain, and now that you've got pain, you can't really sleep well because, well, you've got pain. Mm-hmm. And the actual cause is not nearly as important as the fact that now you've got pain, so your sleep is disrupted. And sleep is an ultra-important part of human existence because when you sleep, your brain is really active. It goes through a series of different cycles as it goes through the different stages of sleep. And in each different part, something important is going on. And we're only scratching the surface of how that really happens. But essentially, it's sort of the garbage collector of your brain comes through and picks up all the leftover trash and sort of resets things so that you can face the day well. And if you don't go through those cycles normally, then it's just like your curb at home. If nobody picks up the garbage, then eventually it all builds up. And after a couple of months or a couple of years, you can't get out of your driveway because it's buried in trash. And so a lot of the time I'll spend looking into other biopsychosocial aspects of the patient, in particular their sleep history, to see if this is really, once the pain's crept into their sleep, then you need to make sure that you're really looking for these other sort of deeper centralized pain syndromes, because you're going to have to get those under control because nothing else you're going to do. I mean, if you can't get out of the driveway, doesn't really matter what your other medications or surgeries you've got, you're still stuck in the driveway.
Let's plan on just taking our normal half break at this particular time. I think this is fascinating, but I know listeners really want to get into some of the particular causes and a little bit more of the detail, the more practical information that listeners may have. So let me first remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Once again, our local number, 550-8433. 550-8433, toll-free 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take about a one-minute break, and we'll continue our discussion on chronic pelvic pain with Dr. Bradford Fenton. This is a chance for you to call and give us your questions or ask us your questions or your experiences. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic today is chronic pelvic pain. This is a problem with about a prevalence somewhere in the neighborhood of 10% of women, but one of which only about a third of those women seek medical care for that. Our guest is Anchorage gynecologist and pelvic pain specialist, Dr. Bradford Fenton. We spent the first part of the program kind of talking about the anatomy and physiology of pain and the pelvis, and brought up the factor of how stress, anxiety, different psychological issues, cultural issues, impact on all of us and our experience of pain. And hopefully in the next half of the program, we're going to be discussing individual pain problems, and hopefully we can get a few listeners to call in with their experiences or their particular problems, which we can are more than happy to address as well. If you would like to call or email, our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org, our local number 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening to this program between 8 and 9 on a Monday evening, that's a taped rebroadcast, so we won't be able to answer questions or address your emails. So this is the next 30 minutes would be a good time if you're sitting there wondering about some pelvic pain issues or had some experiences that you might want to share or have questions about. Please call us now. So if I'm a GYN specialist and a patient walks in with some pain, the reason for the person being there is I'm having pelvic pain and it's chronic, you know that much. What are the most common things that go through your mind, first of all, that does that? It may not be the right way that you think. I'm just trying to begin to feather out what are common reasons that women might present to a gynecologist with chronic pelvic pain once that we can figure out.
Sure. So my approach is, well, based on my sort of subspecialty knowledge of the topic. So the history always goes through a number of different important items, including their anxiety and depression. We can talk about how that interacts with pain later. And obviously their sleep. We discussed sleep a little bit. And then a good history will help you nail down what's the main organ. Is this pain from your bladder, pain from your uterus, pain from your rectum, pain from the vulva, or all of them? And then you just really have to move on to your physical exam to get you a better idea of what's going on. Past surgical history also is very important. Many women have had laparoscopies for endometriosis and chronic pelvic pain, which are not really synonymous, but often used that way. Their response to surgery, previous problems such as cesarean deliveries and pain at scar sites, those are also key elements of the history that lets me know where am I going, where am I looking. Duration of pain also helps me think, gee, I wonder if this is start to really be centralized and I need to look for a central pain syndrome. And that's often where my exam will begin. I'll usually include a fibromyalgia tender point exam just to see if they have a global pain syndrome. And I move on from there to a specialty central pain exam looking for pain that's set up in the nerves of the abdominal wall and the spinal cord. Any of those type of pain syndromes have a number of different treatments that you can use for that. From there, the pelvic exam is really very specialized in a chronic pelvic pain patient. You never use a speculum, for example, because that just stirs everything up and then everything hurts and then you've learned nothing, because the point of the exam is to help you and the patient understand where is the pain coming from and to a certain extent rate it. If they have pain, I'll usually ask them to give me a number 1 to 10 so that I know which parts hurt more in relationship to other parts, and that's part of helping to plan their treatment. Which bits are you really going to go after as your main pain generators and which ones are sort of along for the ride? It starts actually on the labia majora on the outside. That's looking for pudendal nerve syndromes, and then includes the vulvar vestibule, which is just inside the labia minora, looking for vulvar pain syndromes called vulvodynia, but really is vestibulodynia. A careful examination of the pelvic floor muscles is next. The pelvic floor muscles are on either side. They
keep all your guts from falling out on the floor when you stand up. So they're really important, and they can become involved in a lot of different pain syndromes. They have a lot of different treatments, some of which is physical therapy, which is both really effective and very low risk. And many patients that we see have these pelvic floor pain syndromes that have just not been addressed. And sometimes that's all they got left. They had their main problem fixed, and now they just have this residual, it's kind of like a Charlie horse in your pelvic floor that just goes on and on and on. From the pelvic floor, sort of go across the organs of the pelvis, looking at the adnexa, which is where the uterus, or rather the tubes and ovaries are, the uterus, sacral ligaments, and posterior cul-de-sac, which is where endometriosis tends to hide, and then back across to the other side, the other adnexa. Then I start to look at the urethra and bladder. Those are looking for bladder pain syndromes. And finally, the uterus. I'm not really interested in sizing the uterus, which is part of the sort of the standard pain exam, but I'm more interested in determining how much pain they've got there. So it's much less of an exam than most women are really used to in terms of its discomfort, because it doesn't involve the speculum. The speculum is really used to assess for cervical cancer and swab the cervix, and that's not really what I'm seeing the patient for, so I can safely pass on that.
Okay. And common reasons off the top of your head that you, is it fair to ask that question from the get-go?
No doubt about it, and that's what patients will present with, and there's about a half a dozen common problems in each of the different organs that we talked about. So on the externally, on the labia majora, you've got pudendal nerve entrapment syndromes. Vulvodynia occurs in the vestibule. Pelvic floor tension myalgias occur all across, obviously, the muscles of the pelvic floor. Those can also have trigger points in them, which is slightly different. Up in the adnexa, which is where the tubes and ovaries are, you can have all sorts of different adhesions, or if you've had a bad case of pelvic inflammatory disease, those can all be stuck down there. Posteriorly is a classic spot for having endometriosis. And endometriosis is a fascinating disease because it's really probably several different diseases with one name. And for the patients that have the pain-causing version of endometriosis, it seems that they always have a history of stress and unhappiness. And it turns out those sort of experiences cause women to secrete a nerve growth factor into their pelvis. And then it's the nerve growth factor that lets nerves grow into the endometriotic implants, which cause the pain, which is very different from the endometriosis that's involved in infertility, which just sort of mechanically glues everything together. So the infertility type, the patients are infertile because they have a mechanical problem, whereas the patients with the pain type often have very little in the way of physical findings on laparoscopy, and you really have to hunt for it sometimes, but they have excruciating pain. And the way I like to point it out, or to create an analogy, is to say they have a bee sting in the pelvis. You know, it's small. You look at it, it's not very big, but it's really painful. And that's because uniquely those lesions have nerves going into them.
All right. That may be interesting for me to come back to, but I do want to take a phone call, and then we have an email that I think we should address. Joe, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Oh, hello. Now, this is going to kind of be interesting. I'm a male.
Yep. So,
but I do have a pelvic pain problem, and it has been diagnosed from not only x-ray, but from MRI as a problem with L4-L5 and L5-S1, okay?
Right.
And it's a huge problem when I go to, for example, get up and try to go somewhere out of the car. It basically immobilizes me.
Okay.
And I don't know that this is the right forum for that.
Right.
I have
right.
had intervention therapy injections into that area. It actually has helped, but it only helps for just a little bit.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, let's ask Dr. Fenton if he wants to know more information or has any comments. So this is a male, but the problem is appears to be neurogenic. So women can have neurogenic pain just like this. What can we do to help this gentleman?
Well, certainly he's already given you the key elements of his history, which is what I'm always going for, and that he's had injections that worked. Mm-hmm. So if the injections work and you know what the injections are, there's a lot of different types of injections, so you have to really drill down there and get the notes for that to know precisely what it is. Then that helps to guide you in exactly where the problem is and what sort of other methods could work. So,
right.
For example...
When I talked to my neurosurgeon who had actually done some work on my neck, he said that there's no problem with the spinal... column, he said the problem is with the facets. That makes sense?
Right. So the facet joints sit on the back, or they're the most posterior and lateral aspects of your spine itself, the bony spine, and they kind of override each other. They are, in fact, little joint capsules, just like you have in your fingers. And so just like in arthritis, those can become inflamed with a number of different problems, and they have a large number of solutions, I would guess, but as the gynecologist, I wouldn't even hesitate or wouldn't try to guess what those are, because from the vagina, they're way away from where I'm working.
Here's a hint. I don't have one of those. Number two, I'm 75 years old and a male. So.
Right. However, you've gotten some relief from injections. And like I said, there's different types of them. So, for example, you can put a corticosteroid into that joint space, which will calm down the inflammation aggressively and right away. And that tells you that you're right. It's a facet joint problem, and you'll need a facet joint cure. And again, I wouldn't be able to guess what that might be. You'd have to ask an orthopedist. Alternatively, if they put bupivacaine or one of the other numbing agents into the space around the nerve root, then really you know it's a nerve root and conduction nerve problem. And then there's a number of different...
I'm actually allergic to bupivacaine.
All right. Well,
they actually did an injection into my left knee with a steroid and then gel one.
Okay, I don't know what that is.
Well, that's what they call it, gel one, and it worked actually really good, and so I'm considering that may be a possibility for the lower spine.
Sounds like it. Again, that's, you know, well away from the vagina, so I wouldn't really be ready to guess on that. And again, you don't really have any parts I take care of. But you've already, the key element is you tried a number of different things, I'm guessing, and you've told me which ones worked, and then you go from there. You stick with what works and don't go with what doesn't.
Okay, well, I appreciate it, and I'm very glad that I don't have one of those things. And so enjoy your talk with those that do. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call, Joe. Rebecca, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. Hey, as a nurse, I am curious. I worked in the emergency department for 10 years and now do recovery and was involved in a lot of OBGYN procedures. And I am finding more and more women just less tolerant of pain in general. And I was curious when you talk about the psychosocial issues. I mean, is that your finding too? Are we just becoming, I don't know, a weaker, I'm not sure what I want to say there, but patients becoming less tolerant of pain.
Well, that's an interesting question that I don't think I have an answer for. Largely as I move forward with my patients, the science of perioperative pain management gets better and better and better. There's a bunch of new guidelines that have been slowly developing, and early in 2016, pain group, pain is where it was published, as a list of 42 different perioperative pain management techniques that can be used, sort of, you know, depending on the surgery. With each of them has various levels of evidence with them, and when you start to really put them all together with the minimally invasive approach that most gynecologists are trained to use nowadays, patients, I think, are doing pretty darn well overall. But that also really depends on your patient mix. So you have, you may be right in your observation, but you have a significant sort of selection bias, is what it would be called in research. If you only see who's in front of you, and same thing with me. I only see who's in front of me for my practice, which had only chronic pelvic pain patients. Well, everybody had pain. It was an 8 out of 10 every day, all day long, and they were all in severe pain. And so, yeah, getting them better in the post-op area was really difficult because they all started at an 8, and then you perform surgery, which generally involves stabbing them in some manner. And so you know you're going to cause more pain. And trying to get that under control afterwards is always an interesting challenge. But I have now a nice practice that includes a wide range of general gynecology patients, and those patients all do very well. I still give them the full range of perioperative pain management techniques. But they do spectacularly well, and they're walking out the door the same day for many of these larger surgeries, which otherwise would have bought you, well, certainly 20 years ago, would have bought you a full week in the hospital.
So one explanation you're saying, we're not saying this is the explanation, but the patient who goes to the emergency room may have other reasons for having more difficult to control pain than a patient that presents somewhere else. She's also saying, though, but this has changed during my period as an ER nurse, and the answer to that be, well, maybe the kind of patient going to the emergency room now is different as well. So that's what you're saying when you say you're having a selection bias, perhaps, that causes this.
Correct. And indeed, I had one too. And it's important when you do research on these patients to acknowledge that. And that's part of, you know, one of the paragraphs in your discussion of papers always written to acknowledge the shortcomings of your papers. And when we do research on patients with chronic pelvic pain, you are always saying, you know, this type of work and these findings really only relates to patients of this ilk. Mm-hmm. And so you always have a table one in your paper, which describes your patients in some depth of who you're talking about. If you've got two groups and you want to describe your groups in some reasonable manner so that you can identify your biases, you can't always avoid them or can't always overcome them, but you can at least acknowledge them when you say, well, I'm finding this. And certainly I don't discount her. She may be entirely correct. It's maybe that she's seeing a lot more patients who have more pain. Maybe that's going on with, you know, rates of depression and alcoholism and all those sort of things tend to weigh into your pain perception. I've worked in a number of different settings where there's a lot of patients who have a heroin or a narcotic addiction, and that totally destroys your brain's normal ability to perceive pain properly. And getting those patients under control is very difficult in a, you know, any kind of standard medical setting.
Gotcha. All
right. Hey, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Rebecca. Let me remind listeners also, once again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Bradford Fenton. We're talking about chronic pelvic pain. If you've got questions or comments, or here's how to get a hold of us over the next 15 minutes or so. Our local number, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. And our email address, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So here's an email. This is a woman who has had lower abdominal pain since 2012, so about 5 years ago. She's seen general practitioners and obstetricians, had an ultrasound and a colonoscopy. She's currently 49. The pain is in her bottom. It feels like something pushing on her rectum when she's sitting. She has had some problems with constipation. She also has a problem where sometimes when doing things like Pilates and some exercises to try to strengthen the pelvic floor, she will have a bladder leaking. She had she thinks the problem is probably related to a weak pelvic floor after an episiotomy 20 years ago, together with kind of a sedentary lifestyle. Is there enough here to help you make any comments about this person's concerns?
Sure. Probably she's right. Largely, that's one of the reasons we tend to not do episiotomies anymore, is because it turns out that there's all sorts of secondary consequences to them. And we used to think it was a great idea. But as time moves forward and we do more research on the different things we do, turns out that was probably not the best idea. Again, in the correct clinical situation, you may have to do one. But from what she's describing, she probably has two almost separate problems, but which would be the problems with her rectum and her maybe irritable bowel syndrome and her leaking, which are really two different organs, but both of them are involving the pelvic floor. And so certainly pelvic floor physical therapy would be a great place to start. Pelvic floor physical therapy does a lot of different things all at once. As the pain guy, I'm really interested in pelvic floor physical therapy because you're using your prefrontal cortex way up in the front of your brain to exert control over a muscle. And when you're exerting control over a muscle, you're rewiring the nerve pathways to promote the descending control of pain. So by working the muscles, really what you're doing is you're working your frontal cortex, your thalamus, and all the descending connections to your pelvic muscles that says, you're under my control now, we're going to do it my way, and we're going to do it right, and we're going to do it this way. And they will obey. Sometimes they're not really very happy about obeying, but that's sort of thing one that you get out of pelvic floor physical therapy is you get regain control, and that also then moves on to control over all the autonomic nerves down there too, because you've taken control. All the autonomic nerves tend to settle down because you've got the somatic nerves are working to keep things at bay. And so the irritable bladder problems, the irritable bowel problems, those will often improve with a round of physical therapy, if only because of the neurologic side. Now, there's also a muscular and a vascular side to this too, whereby practicing with the muscles, it's like learning to throw a baseball. You know, you probably aren't very good at it to begin with, but with enough training and coaching, you can get pretty darn good. A lot of the time, you have to really practice it on your own, and you just see your coach once in a while to show you the right way to do it. But you'll have to have a coach to really get the ball rolling well. And that gets the muscles all working properly, and that brings in the blood supply. So, for example, that you got there, if she's got some problems with thinning or atrophy, you can improve the blood flow in those areas by using the muscles and working on them, and that brings in the blood flow with it, and then all those areas will improve. Careful word there, in case you need to move on to something else, like a posterior repair or something like that. Again, that will depend on a physical exam to really know what's going on there more precisely, but in general, you could say pelvic floor physical therapy is an excellent first step for a good number of these problems.
All right. Yeah, I did not realize that episiotomies are not commonly used as much as they might have been in the past. I'm trying to choose my words carefully. And the another question that this person had relates to whether or not exercise after a needed episiotomy to, in a sense, help the pelvic floor muscles is a useful adjunct to prevent long-term problems related to episiotomy. That makes sense there?
Indeed, and I believe you are totally correct. Okay. It's an excellent idea. I'm trying to remember, I don't remember the actual source of the reference, but I just recently had an article pop up in front of me in one of my various internet feeds of women in France generally have a very low rate of pelvic floor dysfunction after delivery, and they're touting the idea that that's because all women in France have a visit with a pelvic floor physical therapist after their delivery. Mm-hmm. And once you do that, you can solve a lot of problems by staying in front of them at that point in your life.
Okay, good. Mary, you're on line one, and I have to warn both you and Dr. Finn. We have only about 3.5 minutes or so, so I'm sorry, but I wanted to try to take your call.
Thank you. I will try to make it fast. I had a hysterectomy about 20 years ago, and it's not a chronic problem, but intermittently, I get a very, very severe, what feels like to me, nerve pain right through my tailbone. It lasts about anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour. Doesn't seem to matter if I move. It often happens at night, however, but not entirely. And I didn't have any luck resolving this after my hysterectomy, so I just wanted to know if you might have any insights on that.
Certainly. So that sort of thing, probably you are already guessing well, is either a muscle spasm or a nerve-based pain. And you've already hit on the key element of medicine in general in this area, which is you have to tell me how much of a problem this is for you, and that'll determine what do you do next. So if it's a problem that's only at night and you can take a number of different medications for it that are at night, because usually the medications are kind of sedating, then that may be a great approach. If it doesn't really happen very often, and although annoying, doesn't really happen very often, it may not be worthwhile for you to take a medication all the time. That's ultimately for you to decide. There's always something to do. There's always more to do. Sometimes they have more or less risk, but it's always up to you as the patient to decide, yeah, I'm okay taking, for example, an anti-epileptic like gabapentin for days at a time in order just to miss one episode of this shooting pain.
It's because well, I have not been, and you know, it's been a long time. So I guess my concern is if there's anything that might become chronic, it probably happens once every 2 months. So that is good advice. You know, if it doesn't happen more often than that, I can live with it. It's just been something that when I heard the conversation on the radio, sure, I thought I would ask.
Sure. So there, what you're saying, Dr. Finton, is there are pain medications, unfortunately, because you don't know when the pain's going to occur. You're going to have to be taking the pain medicine every day, and so then you have to decide whether or not it's worthwhile.
No doubt. And that's mm-hmm. what always the right. treatment decisions come down right. to in my office. Is this a problem that you want to treat with medications and sort of mm-hmm. put off for a while and hope that they eventually make it go away? Do you want to do something more aggressive and definitive, realizing you're taking more risk in order to get more of a permanent fix?
Right. Okay, Mary, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
You bet. We've got just about 45 seconds or so. One way to end this program would be to have you tell us what you want listeners to take away. What is it that's most important for women in this situation, occasional man, should take away?
There's no benefit to suffering, and that's really a key element of all of medicine's turning out. Pain has no benefit. It's something that needs to be controlled, and if it's causing a problem, then it's not likely to really get better until you address it. So suffering in silence, if you're taking days off, if you're not getting stuff done in your life, it's time to see someone. There's no benefit to suffering.
Dr. Finton, thanks very much for taking the time with me. This is always interesting. I may have spent too much time on the basics, and we didn't get to enough of the individual problems, but I really enjoyed the time I spent with you today. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you for inviting me.
If you want to continue this discussion, you can join KSK on Facebook. You can find that website at or that link at www.alaskapublic.org. Behavioral and mental health problems are very common, and although not widely appreciated, social issues also are very principal in the determinant of health for many Americans. Primary care providers are beginning to add behavioral health specialists in their offices and services, so next week we're going to address that issue on Line 1. Dave Waldron was today's audio engineer, and Eric Bork is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.